The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy. Welcome to Secure in Mind. I have a very special guest with me today, and I'm really excited about this conversation. I think any of us who read a lot of the books or visited a lot of the forums when we were growing up and maybe being a bit naughty with the school Wi-Fi would enjoy some of these conversations. And yeah, I guess without too much prelude or preamble, I'll introduce him and then I'll just get him to give a sense of who he is and a bit of his background, and then we'll delve deeper into that. But welcome, Brett.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Excellent. So, Brett Johnson, your handle was Gollum Fun. On this podcast, I guess a lot of the guests I do speak to, whether they're hackers, whether they're policymakers, whether they're ex-military or current military, I always look to, I guess I really get the human level, understand the human and the motivation behind the policy. And in your case nowadays, I guess you've got sort of two areas, the person that you were focusing on initially, and then now the motivation to do something slightly different. I'll hand it over to you, and let's just explore a bit of your background.
A bit of the background.
Yeah. So,
where to start? Let's start with the United States Secret Service.
Yep.
They called me the original internet godfather.
Hey.
yeah. What a title on that. So how do you get a title like that? Well, 39 felonies, mm-hmm. placed on the United States Most Wanted list, and escaped from prison, and I built the first organized cybercrime communities. They were Counterfeit Library and Shadow Crew, both of those along with Carter Planet, which was created by Dmitry Golubov. Mm. All three of those laid the foundation for the way modern cybercrime channels operate today. The biggest one of the bunch, probably Shadow Crew, was the most well-known of all three. That went up in 2002. 2004, Shadow Crew made the front cover of Forbes with the headline, Who is Stealing Your Identity? October 26, 2004, the United States Secret Service arrested 33 people, six countries, 6 hours. I was the guy who got away.
Yep.
They picked me up about 4 months later, and they give me a job. And I'm the idiot. I'm the idiot that they were good guys. But the thing about breaking the law and being a criminal, at least with me being a criminal, If you don't want to listen to someone, you're not going to. And I was not in a state of mind or the willingness to listen to good advice. So I kept breaking the law during the entire almost year span that I worked with the Secret Service, often from within their offices.
Yep.
They find out after 10 months, I take off on a cross-country crime spree trying to steal enough money to make it down to South America.
Yep.
One morning, I wake up the night before I'd stolen $160,000 from ATM machines. Wake up the next morning, sign on to cartersmarket.com, which is ran by Max Butler, a friend of mine. My name's there, U.S. Most Wanted beside of it. You just made the Most Wanted list. What do you do now? What did I do? I went to Disney World.
You get the hell out of there. Oh, you went to Disney World.
I went to Disney World.
You may as well celebrate.
Oh, yeah. So I lasted about 6 weeks. I paid $20,000 for a timeshare. I rented a timeshare for 9 months.
Yeah.
Paid $20,000 for that. Bought a load of furniture to furnish the place.
Yep.
Lasted about 6 weeks. Secret Service came and got me, sent me to prison.
Yep.
Then I escaped from prison.
How did you do that?
Oh, geez. So how did I do that?
Yeah.
You know, kind of understand that you have to go back to my childhood, man. It's those 39 felonies and all that were not where I began breaking the law. I started breaking the law when I was 10. I come from a family. My mom, I'm from Eastern Kentucky. That's one of these areas in the United States, like the panhandle of Florida, parts of Louisiana, that if you don't have a job, you may be involved in fraud.
Yep.
My mom was a major fraudster in the area. And when I say that, I mean no crime, too big, too small. She stole a 108,000-pound Caterpillar D9 bulldozer at one point. at another point. Yeah, yeah. This woman on D9 Bulldog. That's her. So at another point, she takes a slip and fall in a small shop and tries to sue the owner. She's got a neighbor that she pimps out. At another point, she goes to the store, buys these empty pill capsules, and fills them with powder to try to sell them to drug addicts so she can make money like that. I mean, that was my mom.
Scamming everyone.
Oh, yeah. My dad wasn't like that. My dad was the guy who, he loved my mom so much that he put up with it. Not only did he put up with it, but he became the enabler of the family. If she had an idea, he would support that because he was afraid of losing her. And then finally she leaves him. But I mean, she needed to leave him. I remember one time, the first time I spoke about this, I was at the FBI Academy yesterday talking. Mm. And the first time I've ever mentioned this story was yesterday. Mm. But I'm 10, my sister's 9. We come home from school, and my mom, as we're walking into the yard, the hood of the car is up. Mm. We don't know why, but it turns out that she has cut the spark plug wires on the car so that my dad can't get away. So, yeah. So we walk in and she's hit him in the head. We went throughout Europe. I was an army brat.
Yeah.
We traveled throughout Europe and collected all these little items and everything, furniture and everything. So she has hit him in the head with this big marble statue. To this day, he's still got a piece of marble embedded in his skull. So, we walk in and this has been what's happening. She's got spaghetti on the stove, the sauce and the noodles. And she looks at us and she says, "Don't eat the spaghetti." And we're like, "Why? That's just for your father." Well, it turns out she's put Decon rat killer in the spaghetti to try to kill him. And this was my mom. I mean, this is what she did. She used to bring men home, parade in front of him. He would sit there and cry and beg her not to do it. And she would do it anyway. So she finally leaves him. When she leaves him, I don't see my dad again I don't have a conversation with him for 30 years. Mm. Not until I'm arrested and sentenced to prison. He shows up at my sentencing, stands up in front of the judge, and he tells the judge, "I'm here for Brett. I want to make sure he has a good start when he's released. He can come and live with me," all this other stuff. So he starts visiting me in prison. About the third visit, he looks at me and he was like, "You know, I've been reading about you online." And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Okay." He's like, "That's a lot of money you made." I'm like, "Yes, sir."
Yeah.
He was like, "You think you could teach somebody how to do that?" Yeah, because I was the guy that in the United States, we've got this thing called tax return identity theft. I'm the guy who started that. And I was stealing a lot of money. So he had read the articles and he had read all these groups that I was running and everything. So, and what I've done before when I've told people that, how I escaped, I've laid the blame on my dad. But the truth of the matter was, is my dad, I think that where he hadn't seen me in 25, 30 years, that he still associated me as a child with that environment with my mom.
Yep.
And I think that was the only way he thought he could communicate with me.
Yep.
So what I did was I saw that and I manipulated the man into helping me escape. I had him, I was at a minimum security camp. I had a job outside of the fence. I had him drop off a package with some money, an ID, a cell phone, a change of clothes. I lasted about 6 weeks at the minimum security, and then I escaped. I was on the run for about 3 to 4 weeks at that point. U.S. Marshals, they come and get me, arrest me, and then they send me to a real prison, which was in West Texas, where you don't escape. And it's a good thing, you know, looking back, at that point in time, I thought I had hit rock bottom, and I guess I had. But looking back, me going to prison was probably the best thing that could have happened.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it took about 2.5 years for me to get to the point where I understood, because I was the guy who always justified everything. You know, I said I broke the law for my family, for my sister, for my wife, for my stripper girlfriend. And it took about 2.5 years for me to say, no, I broke the law because I chose to break the law.
Yeah.
You know, I hurt all those people, lied to everyone because that was my choice to do that.
Yeah.
And I think if I hadn't went to prison, you know, I served, I was sentenced to 7.5 years, served almost, well, a little bit over 6 years total. I think if I hadn't served that I would probably be doing 20 or 30 years in prison right now. So it was a good thing.
Well, I can relate to that.
Well, I hope not.
Well, not to the extent, but, I'm a reformed, drug addict and, you know, it kind of the justifications that you have.
Absolutely.
You can make an excuse for anything if you want to get messy again. And,
And I don't know about the drugs, but I imagine it's probably about the same. I mean, with me, the most important thing in my life was crime. You know, I would tell someone that I love them, but I didn't love them as much as I love breaking the law.
Yeah. And that's it, right? You've kind of got this priority, but then this one trumps it. And that's why you can go, you know, in a certain way, but there's often the niggling in the niggling voice. For me, it took a lot of days, no sleep, and flying off a balcony and ending up in a hospital. And
Oh, geez.
Yeah. And I look back in it now, and one of my buddies at the time just goes, "Mate, that's the smartest thing you've done.
Best thing you could have ever done."
Wrapped up in this weird gift of broken limbs, but truly, I mean, I look back at myself. I look at myself now and compare that to what I was, and he was right, and I'm thankful that I went through that transition. But your home wasn't, there wasn't a divorce, but I remember. Prior to, I think when I was 10 years old, a lot of the ground sort of like got taken away from under my feet, and there was a big divorce. There were, you know, police, and there were children's courts, and there was there was assault, and there was violence, and court things. And that's, I think, when a switch flicked in my head for quite a while. And so therefore, you know, pursuing this path of being just a little shit, basically.
Right.
You know, for 10 years or something, until I, you know, got the slap in the face that I needed for myself. And I guess a question would be, when you look back on it now, and having turned over a leaf, having served time, and now having working with the guys to try and catch fraudsters, I guess it, let me rephrase this question. When I sort of think about people who are down in the dumps and, you know, committing criminal acts, I certainly don't try and pitch them whole straight away. There's a level of empathy. I guess I kind of can understand maybe where they're coming from. And do you find that as well nowadays? And is that why you're so good at sort of identifying ways and avenues which can be manipulated?
You know, I think that is a part of it. You know, I've been there. I went through the entire spectrum from the low-level crimes. You know, the first online crime I committed was selling fake Beanie Babies. And my fake Beanie Baby, that was it. So I was trying to get my butt over to China to buy some out of the factory, but couldn't do that. So what I did was, is they had the big one to buy was this Peanut the Royal Blue Elephant. And couldn't find the little guys. So I got these little gray elephants, and I would dye them blue. Yeah.
And, so you, you know, definitely you started off small, didn't you?
Oh yeah. Didn't know anything at all about it. Yeah. And you know, they would come out, they were polyester, so they wouldn't hold the dye. You'd get them out, they'd look like they have the mange.
Yeah.
But what I would do is I'd find a picture of a real one, post it, and then I'd send someone, you know, the fake blue one. And of course, they would know it was fake, but I would say maybe it was damaged in transit. I don't know. So I went through all of that, and I've seen my associates over the years have been the top names in cybercrime. Mm. You know, the top Albert Gonzalez, Max Butler, Dmitry Golubov, Roman Vega.
Do you still keep in touch with those guys as well, or any of them?
A couple. Most of the guys that I talk with are very. They're okay. I've had one guy that has been just angry that I'm doing what I'm doing. You know, why am I going against everything that we were? That type of mentality.
Yeah.
But most guys are very happy. One of the guys that I spoke to recently, his name was Kevlar. Yeah. He made one of the best fake IDs that I had ever seen at that point in time.
Yeah.
Nowadays, he's grown up. He's got a family, and he's telling me, you know, he's like, you know, times are hard. But I am so much happier now than I used to be. You know, I don't have to worry about knocks at the door. Or anything else like that. You know, what I see now, I see people that it's that cognitive dissonance.
Mm.
It's the inability to understand the damage that you're doing and the amount. A lot of people think that crime is easy, that it's a quick buck. But the truth of the matter is that breaking the law online requires a lot of work and a lot of time to do it properly. And that's one of the things that I see over and over again is these guys don't really understand that. They're, you know, I make my own hours. Mm. I can work when I want to, and I make good money. Well, you make good money until you get caught and go to prison. Then you add up how much you're making an hour overall.
You're
not doing that well. Yeah. So there's a lot of just not thinking properly. And what I do is I still use the Gollum Fund name. In some channels, I use some undercover names when I'm working with security or law enforcement, things like that.
Mm.
What I try to do is under the Gollum Fund name, if someone comes up to me, and I get that pretty often, one of these new kids or even an older guy will come up and say, you know, hey, how do I do this crime? How do I properly secure it and steal money? And my response is, well, you don't, because obviously you stopped at reading how much money I stole. You didn't read the consequences of anything. And their response,
it's not even fine print. It's black and white.
Right. It's black and white. But the thing is their response is always the same. Their response is, why would I go to school, get a certificate of security, anything else, when I'm making this amount of money here right now? And that's the problem, is that they only see that part. They blind themselves to everything else. So, you know, I'm not, I don't dislike these guys. I don't hate them. I understand that that they're playing the deck of cards that they're dealt, that hand that they're dealt at that
point.
I hope that, you know, most of the guys that I've talked to, I tell them that I hope that they can get out of it before they really do themselves damage, their family, friends, everybody else. Because that's one of the things that people don't know. I didn't understand that when I broke the law. You know, I thought initially it was just me, but come to find out, it hurt friends, family. You know, I lied to friends, family, to people I didn't know. The consequences, the repercussions of that are ongoing to this day.
Both externally and internally. There's an amazing, I mean, it's one of the best television series ever created, but The Wire. I mean, you know, it's a show that just really digs deep, and it shows you the layers of society, a degradation of society through crime, through violent crime, through drugs. But it looks at all these factors, and you know, like you said, I mean, you can't hate some of these. I mean, you know, even unless it's a sociopath, and even then, I guess they've been given a card from the deck. Where how did they have any choice over that biological predetermination?
Right.
What do you do with that? What do you do
now? Now, with me, I'll tell you. With me, you know, I look back at my childhood, and I'm adamant at saying that my choices as an adult were mine. My childhood did not make me break the law. I chose to do that.
But
you know, at the same time, I've got a real problem reconciling that, because I know I got the criminal mindset from my mom and that entire side of the family.
Yeah.
So how do I reconcile the upbringing that I had versus my choices as an adult? Because I know they're my choices. So I'm still trying to work that puzzle out. You know, it's difficult.
It's ongoing. I mean, on a different extent, but I guess from an alcoholism extent, you know, that's my old man, black and white. And I struggle through that too. And that's been a long process, but it's interesting. I think there are a lot of parallels between a mindset, which is kind of really destructive, but the highs and lows that you achieve from, you know, criminal exploits are similar to the highs and lows that you achieve as an addict. But at the end of the day, like, the lows are really shit.
Oh, yeah. You know, with us, when we started out, none of us really knew anything. So if you look at cybercrime now, the people who are coming in, that's just the entry level people who are coming in trying to be cyber criminals, they are much more educated than we were when we started.
Yeah.
So a guy coming in now, he can specialize in one specific field and do okay.
Yeah.
Back then, you had to learn every single area of the overall cybercrime dynamic to understand it and to commit the crime. You know, and that's the thing is, you know, when we were learning, we had a blast. I'm not going to lie to you. It was fun. It was exciting. You know, we were the little David trying to beat the big Goliath of the government or the companies and things like that.
And we were pioneers. Yeah.
But, and as we went on, I mean, it doesn't become fun anymore. It becomes a job. And then at some point, you're aware that law enforcement is looking at you and things are going to go bad. You're going to go to prison at some point. But what happens, and I noticed that across the board with every single person that I served in prison with, most everyone there knew at some point that law enforcement was coming, that they were going to end badly. We knew that. We had intercepted text messages from the Secret Service about them investigating us, and we kept on going. At that point, you have to adopt this philosophy of fatalism and say, hey, whatever's going to happen is going to happen.
So, which is also even more destructive.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, fantastic. I've really, really enjoying the discussion thus far. I would like to move into some of the more specifics about Carter Planet, about Shadow Crew, about some of the tech, and then once you've laid sort of the you know, maybe some timelines attached to that, the creation, some of you, the co-conspirators. But then after that, we can do a comparison between the then and now, like we just lightly touched on them, but, you know, how much technology's changed, how much methodology's changed, et cetera. So yes, Carter Planet, Shadow Crew. And the lead up to, and which years, et cetera.
Sure. It starts with Counterfeit Library. That's where it starts. So what happened was, is my entry.
Which year was this, sorry?
This would have been 97, 98.
Gotcha.
Would have been this. So this actually starts with my entry into it. I was, at that point in time, I was pirating software, selling pirated software. I was doing mod chips into cable systems to turn on all the channels on cable boxes.
Okay.
About the same time, a Canadian judge ruled that it was legal for Canadian citizens to pirate satellite DSS signals, those small 18-inch satellite systems by RCA.
Okay.
They weren't selling those in Canada. So the judge reasoned, he was like, hey, since RCA isn't selling them, it's not illegal for my citizens to pirate the signal.
Yeah.
So what happens is, for anybody in the U.S., So in the U.S., what you could do is you'd go down to the shop, buy one of the systems for $100, take it out in the parking lot, open it, pull the card out, throw the system away, program the card, ship it to Canada, $500 a piece.
Bang. Wow.
Started doing that, making a lot of money.
Yep.
Had too many orders to fill. Thought to myself, why do I need to fill any of them?
Yep.
They're in Canada. I'm down here. Who are they going to complain to? So I didn't fill any of the orders, stole even more money at that point, got to where I was worried about how much was coming in. I was making about $4,000 a week at that point.
And sorry, how did you advertise? Because this is before the days of eBay. Were you advertising in the paper?
No, This was eBay. This was eBay, and there was a website called Classifieds 2000, kind of a precursor to Craigslist at that point.
Okay.
All right. So I was stealing that money, and what happens is I figure the best thing I can do in order to avoid some sort of money laundering charge is to get a fake ID, open up a bank account under that fake ID, launder the money through there, pull it out of the ATM machine.
Yep.
Get online, look around for a fake ID, can't find one. Finally, find a guy who says he has them. Send him $200, send him my picture. The guy rips me off and I get mad. I'm mad at the guy, but I still need the fake ID. So I keep looking and complaining wherever I can complain. I find this website, and the website was counterfeitlibrary.com. And Counterfeit Library, the only thing they dealt in were counterfeit degrees and certificates. That was it. They didn't have a real cybercrime circuit. It was just degrees.
Yeah.
But they had this forum there that was defunct. No one was using it. I was one of the first three people on there. So there was me. There was a guy named Mr. X from Los Angeles. There was another one. He went by the screen name of Beelzebub from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. So I get on there, and the only thing I do is bitch, moan, and complain. I was stolen from. I have been ripped off. I cannot believe someone did that to me. That lasts about 2 weeks. Meanwhile, I'm befriending the admins that run the website. You know, I'll talk to them every now and then and all that, and we've become kind of friends. Well, after about 2 weeks, the guy from Moose Jaw, his name was Beelzebub, he gets me on ICQ and starts talking to me. He was like, Gollum, tell you what, I can make you an ID. And I was like, well, make me one. He's like, no. He said, you're going to pay me for it. He said, this is what he told me. He's like, at some point, you have to try, if you're going to be in this business, you have to trust someone online.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I'll tell you what, I'm going to send you $200. That way, when you rip me off, I can bitch about you too. So I sent him $200, sent him my picture. About 10 days later, I get an ID from Indiana. The ID was in the name of Stephen Schwecki. He's a real guy. He's a real guy. He works at ADP payroll to this day. He was my first victim. I thought it was the prettiest thing I'd ever seen at that point in time. And I go about cashing checks, setting up accounts under it, everything else. What happened was, that was the genesis of this entire thing that we kind of built from that point. Beelzebub wants to sell fake IDs. Mr. X makes a very passable fake social security card out of Los Angeles. So that's where we started, was with fake IDs, fake social security cards. I didn't really know anything at all about that game at all. But what Beelzebub said was, is he was like, hey, why don't you be the reviewer? That way, any single product or service that comes in here, you can say, I've looked at it, it works. And not only that, but you learn about it, you learn how to use it, you get first dibs on everything. So I was like, that's a good idea. Let's do that. So it was like this movie Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. Mm. We were really the first organized group at that point. Before that, you had to rely on IRC or something like that if you were looking to network or buy product or anything else like that.
Mm.
Counterfeit Library established this trust mechanism. And the trust mechanism was based around this idiot right here, Brett Johnson. If I said that I had gotten a product in, that's what I meant. Mm. If I vouched for someone, and it holds true to this day.
Mm.
If you vouch for another criminal online, you take responsibility for that person.
Yeah, yeah.
So if that person rips you off, it falls back on you. You said the guy was good. And I live by that. If I vouch for someone or reviewed someone and said the product was good, the person lost money, didn't get delivery of it or anything else like that,
I would
reimburse the person. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's where it built up. At one point, I had a hand in every single transaction that took place on Counterfeit Library. So what happens is...
And what kind of percentages were you taking?
There was none.
Oh, there wasn't. Oh, wow.
No percentage whatsoever.
Okay.
And there was very little protection too. Back then, we didn't even understand what proxies were yet. So everything was just wide open. Yeah. But law enforcement didn't understand any of that stuff either at that point.
Yeah.
So what happens is this kid over in the Ukraine, his name is Dmitry Golubov. Mm. He sees Counterfeit Library, and we've got 2,000 to 3,000 members by this point on the forums. Things are buzzing around pretty good. We've got people from Pakistan, from India that are bringing products and services that we're all trying to teach them how to commit the crimes, you know, from eBay fraud, PayPal cashing out, setting up bank accounts, everything else.
And just a quick question. When you say they're bringing products, what do you mean?
So the first products we sold were the fake Social Security fake ID.
Gotcha.
The next product that came in was a guy from Pakistan. His name was Mubin, and he sold computer certificates, real computer certificates. So
really?
He would take the test all the way from A+ through CCIE. He would take the test in whatever name you wanted the test taken in, and you would get the certificate in your name.
Okay.
So that's the next product we had in. From there, it was more fake IDs coming in. Tutorials started to be sold about how to defraud eBay, how to cash out PayPal.
Yeah.
We started to see some influx of credit cards, but not many at all until this guy, Dmitry Golubov, comes into the scene. So he was in the Ukraine. He saw the success we were having with Counterfeit Library. He was spamming at that point in time. And his thing was, you know, I'm getting all these credit card numbers. Mm-hmm. I wonder if I can sell those things. Turns out you can. He, depending on which tell you believe, he calls everyone that he knew in Odessa. They have a meeting of 150 people, and they design Carter Planet, which is probably exactly what happened. Because Carter Planet, it was a very close-knit group. Everyone there knew each other.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to have a review system or anything else. They only allowed those specific sellers in there. Where we didn't know each other, we had the review system. We had the vouching system going on, everything else like that. So what happens is, Dmitry, Roman Vega, all these other people, they build Carter Planet.
Mm.
The problem was at that point in time for the Ukraine, for that entire Eastern Bloc of Europe, you could not cash a card out. There was so much fraud over there already that all the cards had been shut down. Well, if you look at the way cybercrime operates, there are three things that have to take place for cybercrime to be successful. You have to gather data, commit a crime, cash out.
Yep.
The cash out was the problem, the major problem for the Ukrainians. They couldn't put cash in pocket. So what we see one day is
why couldn't they?
Because even if you were a legitimate card holder, you couldn't get cash out of an ATM. Every single card in that region was blocked at that point in time.
Wow.
Because Ukrainians had already been running so much fraud at that point.
Okay.
So they had to rely on someone outside of region to put cash in pocket. So what Dmitry does, I'm over there. I'm head of I'm head of Counterfeit Library at this point. Beelzebub has went back to growing marijuana. Mr. X has been arrested in Los Angeles. I'm the last guy standing of that initial three.
Hmm.
One day we see this new name pop up on Counterfeit Library, and the name was Script. And he said, I'm Russian. Hmm. I've got a load of credit card data that I would like to start selling here. What you can do is you give me an address, you give me a phone number, wait 5 business days, order whatever you want to on these cards. It will arrive to you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had never really seen anything like that. So the initial response from the members was, this has got to be law enforcement. This is law enforcement. They're trying to arrest us all. That lasted. I mean, there was a lot of drama on that. That lasted for 4 to 5 days. I was scared to review the guy because I thought he was law enforcement too.
Yeah.
I was the only reviewer at that point. So after about 5 days, I get on ICQ, contact him, send him a message. I was like, hey, man, you have to be reviewed. He was like, reviewed? What are you talking about? And I was like, look, in the United States, we have a review system. Mm. If you want to sell on this site, I'm going to review you. And he was like, fine, let's go. Mm. So I give him an address, give him a phone number, wait 5 business days, try to hit Dell.com for $5,000 of computer equipment. It fails. It doesn't go through. So I get him back on ICQ, contact him. I'm like, hey, man, it didn't work. Yeah. He was like, give me one more try. I was like, look, I'll give you one more chance, but after that, that's your ass.
Done. Yeah.
He was like, okay, one more try. I'm like, gotcha. So give him another address, another phone number, wait 5 business days. I defraud Thompson's Computer Warehouse out of $4,000, Dell.com out of $5,000. Mm. Order arrives. Now, here's what the interesting thing on that. I post the review on Counterfeit Library. Before I posted the review, Counterfeit Library was a site that dealt in identity theft and eBay fraud, defrauding the person. All right. Mm. Once I post that review, it's like overnight, our entire focus shifts from that type of identity theft to a credit card theft based site.
Yep.
That's what happened. So Script begins selling there. From then, it's Roman Vega comes in. He went by the screen name of Boa. At one point I was his only US seller of credit cards. All these other people start popping in from that point. Now, the way Shadow Crew pops up, we were in Counterfeit Library. Mm-hmm. We had a section of the site that, just because the people that ran the website Counterfeit Library, they were selling counterfeit degrees. Mm-hmm. So we had a sub forum there that just dealt with counterfeit degrees.
And just get a timeline check. What year was this roughly?
This would have been, by this point, 99, 2000, I'm guessing.
Yep.
So what happens is we were selling these fake degrees from degree mills. There was a real guy out there. I'm not really sure the guy's name. I think it was John Engel, but he dealt with real distance learning universities.
Okay, absolutely authentic. Yeah,
absolutely. So he found out that we were running degree mills.
Yeah.
And he had this big website, and he had all these members following him and everything. So he tells his members, this website is stealing from us. Mm. So his members start coming in and just flooding, just trolling the website. That's all they do. And the way that forum was ran at that point, we didn't have moderators. I was really the only admin, but I didn't do anything. I just let it go. So they were kind of taking over, flooding with posts and everything else. It was very hard to conduct business at that point. Mm. Well, about the same time, this guy named Seth Sanders, he was a fake ID maker. That's the only thing he did, is he created fake driver's licenses. Mm. So he's disgusted with what Counterfeit Library has become, because it started out as a fake ID site. Mm. Now it's credit cards. So he comes to me and he was like, Gollum, do you mind if I go out and make another site? And I'm like, dude, do whatever you want, man. Mm. My blessings to you. So this guy goes off, creates the website, shadowcrew.com. Mm-hmm. The problem was, no one visited it. He had like 60 members, because the only thing he was talking about was fake IDs. By that point, they only wanted credit cards. So he had 80 members registered. Meanwhile, we're getting flooded on Counterfeit Library. He comes back to me a couple months later, and he was like, Gollum, I've got an idea. Mm. I'm like, what's your idea? He was like, look, he said, you're having trouble over here with these floods. Mm. He said, I've got everything moderated over there, set up pretty good. Why don't you bring everyone over there and we'll set up shop there? And I was like, I'll tell you what, not a bad idea. I'll do that if you let me create some other sub forums, let me have super admin access, let me call who's in charge of which forums. And he was like, do you? I'm like, okay. So within 48 hours, we shut down Counterfeit Library's forum. Everyone transitions over to Shadow Crew, and that's where that starts from that point.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And that's around the year 1999 to 2000. How long was Shadow Crew in
existence? Shadow Crew was only up about 2 to 3 years, something like that. It wasn't up very long at all.
So if you just think, I mean, if you compare with some of the marketplaces nowadays, which are hosted on Tor, for example, and some of the recent takedowns, I think there were two recent takedowns, Wall Street Market and something else.
Valhalla.
The amount of money that has gone through them, and the amount of money being, you know, they're clipping the ticket from the admin. What kind of figures do you think you were running through Shadow Crew in its existence in its 3 years?
You know, when we were doing it, so just an upper level carder, someone that was committing credit card theft online for card not present fraud.
Yeah.
I was profiting, stealing $30,000 to $40,000 worth of product and cashing out at $30,000 to $40,000 a month. So that was the top tier guys just on credit card fraud.
Yeah.
What happens with us is we've discovered this thing called the CVV1 hack was what it was called. So we were spamming all this information. We were getting debit and credit card numbers with the PINs.
Yep.
The problem is that to encode that on the back of a plastic card to cash out at an ATM, you have to know the entire track two. And track two looks like it's a 16-digit card number. There's an equal sign there. Then there's a 16-digit algorithm outside of that. You can't just guess the algorithm. You have to know it. So we weren't getting the algorithm. But what happens is one of our Ukrainian buddies, he discovers, guess what? Washington Mutual Bank, they haven't implemented the hash on track two. What does that mean? Well, that means you can take the card number and equal sign any 16 digits. It encodes you can take to the ATM. So it starts with Washington Mutual. Then we start testing all these other banks. It turns out in the United States, none of the banks had implemented that hash.
Wow.
So we were stealing just on CNP, on card not present fraud. We were stealing $30,000 to $40,000 a month per person for the upper tier guys.
Yeah.
Once the CVV1 hack becomes exposed and we start implementing or taking advantage of that, that turns into $30,000 to $40,000 a day. Now, as I pointed out, the Ukrainians, they weren't able to run any cards over there. So they had to rely on people out of region. Yeah. So what happens is you get this entire industry of these money mules, these cashiers that are out there. And the Ukrainians, what they did was, is they said, hey, we will send you track two data with the PIN. What we want is we want 60% of the cash back. You guys keep 40%. And the idea, and I used to say this all the time, a criminal, seller, cashier, whoever that may be, he will continue to work with you and benefit you as long as it's viable for him to do that.
Yep.
So as long as that criminal believes that he will continue to get these dumps, he will give you that 60% cash. But at some point, he's going to stop believing that. You're going to miss. You're going to miss a dump. He's going to miss a payment, something like that. And he's going to steal from you. So that's the way this cybercrime thing works to this day. Back then, that's the way it was. And so you know, you're stealing $40,000 a day out of ATM machines. You're sending back $32,000 of it, or $30,000, or whatever that is, 60%. You're sending that back. You're pocketing $10,000 a day.
And this is all on the credit cards doing direct international money transfer, international money withdrawal on the credit cards. So
that's you'd go to an ATM, you'd pull the money out of the ATM, and then you'd have to send the 60% to the Ukrainians if you were partnered with the Ukrainians, if you hadn't learned how to fish that data yourself yet.
Yeah, so, and how did you send the money to the Ukrainians?
That's the problem. Yeah. So it starts out, of course, with Western Union. Well, guess what? You can't send $30,000 every day.
Hey, Bob, good to see you again.
Exactly. So what happens is we have a precursor to Bitcoin, and that precursor was called eGold. And it worked almost exactly. You didn't have the blockchain, but the funding mechanism, everything else worked almost identically the way the cryptocurrencies work today.
Yep.
So you would fund your Bitcoin account, and you would transfer Bitcoin, or not Bitcoin, but eGold, over to the Ukrainian that you were dealing with at that point.
Was that a precursor to web money over in there as well?
Ah, web money was another one. Absolutely. So it was all about the same time. You had web money, you had eGold. Of course, the eGold guy, he was out of the Caymans. He gets arrested a couple years later for money laundering.
Yeah.
And almost immediately, there's another one that pops up called Liberty Reserve, which came on after that. Right.
Yeah. Okay. And that's sort of the past. How much has it changed? You know, if we look at sort of technologies like Tor and everything, but you know, some of the principles. And what I find fascinating is, the mechanisms between, say, nation states and law enforcement working cross border. You don't get the bureaucratic necessities and blockages. And look, there are plenty of successes out there and plenty of international coordination efforts where you've got international bodies like Europol or Interpol or United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, the chief of whom has also been on this podcast. But there's just this simple, there's more of a simpleness to the motivation and the connection for working in cross-border collaboration, which is you benefit.
Right.
Don't worry about red tape. We're doing it. I mean, do you still see that? Do you see that improving with tech?
On the criminal side, a lot of the things are still the same. So you've still got the we were always the groups that were very big on sharing information.
Yeah.
So we've always been ahead of the good guys when it comes to collaborating with each other. Now we're seeing the good guys now. the good guys now are very good about exchanging information at the governmental and law enforcement levels.
Yeah.
What's not good are companies sharing information with each other. So you got a company in a vertical that's being hit. Well, that company is this little microcosm. It's not going to share any data with any other company about the way they're being attacked or who's attacking them or anything else like that. Until that other company's hit and no one shares information. The bad guys have always been good about sharing information. So you've still got that trust mechanism that's there with the bad guys that establishes who you can deal with, if they're trustworthy, if you can buy product, how good the product is, and everything else.
Which is kind of ironic. I mean, if you talk to people outside of the game, you might think that's slightly ironic.
Right.
But you do need this kind of vetting process. And in say, you know, where I'm from, Australia, they made a law which I think has been quite flaccid since its implementation. But it's basically the force breach disclosure. So if you get done, you have to publicize within a set X amount of time saying we got stung. But also there's the, you know, there's the push to make enterprises, you know, bite the bullet and say, if you get done, you get done, right? But as long as you're sharing that information with market, then it's kind of like, herd immunity. You're improving your competitors from a capitalistic shareholder's sense. But generally speaking, the Australian society is going to be better off if you share that information to some of your competitors, because then they can assist themselves and both vice versa. You know, there's not those kind of blockages or competitive sort of advantages that maybe had with keeping that information at bay. Yeah.
No, you're right. You're right. And so we have to get better about sharing information, because the bad guys are all about sharing information.
Yeah.
You look at Tor. The thing is with Tor, if you know how to use it properly, you can remain anonymous. The problem is that most of these idiots out there have no idea.
Yeah.
look at the Wall Street guys.
Yeah.
So they steal at least $59 million out of the coffers that were in the Wall Street wallets. $59 million. And then some idiot uses his VPN, forgets to click the little thing that says, hey, if the VPN drops, and then exposes his real IP. Come on, guys. Come on. So it's not.
You're right. I was reading. It just reminds me of a blog. This guy's just dicking around with I think the guy was Ukrainian. Yeah, the Ukrainian banker, criminal, and it was toying around and he set up some honey traps and everything.
Oh yeah.
Then he got the guy knocking at the door. Got the guy knocking a bit more. Then he built this quick site on the flyer, subdomain on the flyer. And then basically what he did, he forced the guy to strip off his VPN. And you must have heard that, you know, the cold burning and the guy's, you know, halfway across the world, the guy going, well, I'm already in now. So anyway, as soon as you did that, it's like, I gotcha. So whoever you are,
and you know, that's the thing, is that a lot of people don't really understand that. But just because you're a cyber criminal doesn't mean that you're invulnerable. It doesn't mean that you're this ultra great expert at security or anything else. It doesn't mean that.
Yeah.
You know, the cyber criminals that I know, and I know the guys from the bottom all the way up to the top, the guys that I know are just as susceptible to phishing as anyone else is.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and so are top people in, you know, security agencies, so are the top people in Intel, so are top people in, everyone is, they're human. I guess we're coming to a bit of a close, but the final thing I'd love to do is discuss what you do now. Obviously, that's a form of life, and it's a huge amount of information and great know-how that you're able to apply. Kind of a catch me if you can, you know, thing has been conjured up in my head. So your clients are private sector. You mentioned yesterday you're at FBI HQ. What kind of things do you discuss? Do you do training? And also, do you feel like it's falling on deaf ears? Do you feel like there is a shift? Is it mixed?
You know, so let's handle the falling on deaf ears thing first. Yep. What I notice time and time again are, a lot of the times, the troops on the ground know exactly what's going on. But the problem is that management doesn't, but management tries to tell everyone what's going on. Okay. So I think that at that level, and that's one of the things I try to preach, is that it's important, because security tends to be reactive, not proactive. It's important to try to catch up, and not only catch up, but to surpass what the criminals are doing. Well, you can't do that if you're always reacting. So I think one of the ways that we get to a proactive state is just to delegate more power, not always have to go through channels to get permission to do something. You know, I think that we're being hit with fraud. Let me write a memo and wait 2 weeks on it to see what management would like to do about that. So I think we need to decentralize the power some and spread authority throughout more people so that, you know, if someone sees something that's happening, if you see in the United States, if you see synthetic fraud that's happening at a bank or something like that, instead of having to go through all these channels, you know, hey, this is synthetic fraud. I'm going to freeze the account right now instead of waiting 2 to 3 days for the criminal to withdraw even more money. So I think that's part of it. What I do these days, I do a lot of speaking. I consult with financial institutions, with Fortune 50, Fortune 500 companies. I work free with law enforcement. Usually what I do, if I go into a city or something and I speak, I try to find a university there or a college there that I can go in and speak to a class as well. And I work with law enforcement. I talk to kids, you know, students and everything. I do that without charge. That's part of how I try to pay back, make amends for the damage that I've done over the years.
But do
a lot of consulting. Consulting is all about getting people to understand the criminal mindset. Not only that, but looking at how that specific company or even the person will be attacked. So it's important to understand that every single person and organization has a place in the cybercrime spectrum. What is your place? If you have a company, how will you be attacked? Understand that. So do you have data that can be sold on a marketplace, or do you have data that's just specific to your company? Well, if you understand that, then you'll understand how you will be attacked. Is it a breach that's looking to steal data? Is it a ransomware attack that's looking to lock down your data and charge you to get access to it? So understand that. The same thing for a person. If I'm looking to victimize a person, I will victimize a person differently that's a CEO or that works in payroll compared to someone that works in food service for 20 years. But both of them can still be victims. So it's important to understand your place in the cybercrime spectrum. So I talk about that a lot, and also run tests. So if you're doing security awareness training, there's a difference between training for compliance and training for effectiveness. In the United States, we have HIPAA, which is healthcare. That's compliance. Over in the UK, they've got GDRP or GDPR. It's checking boxes. A criminal doesn't give a damn about GDPR. They don't care about that.
Oh, you've got GDPR?
I'm so scared now. It's fine. It's fine to have compliance, but also have training awareness for effectiveness. And what I advocate for that is using the same type of means, those types of attacks that a criminal would do. Test using that.
That way the
employees, the management, every person else there knows exactly what the criminals are doing, the types of tools that they're using, what that type of attack looks like. So when they see it, they can better recognize it. Now, even that. That's not going to stop all crime, but it will take a big chunk out of it. I also advocate
get rid of the low hanging fruit.
And you know, better yet, it's teaching people not just to be secure at work, but to be safe throughout their entire online life. If you teach someone to be safe at home online, that will translate to the work environment too. So I talk about that, and you know, the thing is I was talking at the FBI yesterday. I had a guy that asked me a question, and he was right. He was like, it looks like you're putting the entire onus on the companies and the person. What about the criminal? And he was absolutely right about that. We have to be proactive in our response. There are ways to attack that doesn't mean you're hacking the criminals, but you can attack them emotionally. You can do what the FBI did 2 days ago. They shut down deep.web. And I loved deep.web. I loved that site. But in truth, that site was one of the main places to go if you were looking to see which markets you should shop on. So by taking that information away, you hurt an entire spectrum of people trying to come into the cybercrime environment. I expect we'll see the exact same thing happen on Reddit within the next 7 to 10 days. I think Reddit will shut down some more of these sub forums that deal with darknet markets, the drug trafficking, things like that as well. So I think you start taking away the information that gives access. You start sowing disinformation within these forums and subgroups as well. That way you get to the point where no one knows who they can trust anymore. You have to circumvent that trust mechanism that's been established.
There's so many layers to that strategy, because obviously shutting down a forum or a vessel where you can communicate and even disrupting trust, you've still got disenfranchised, you know,
oh, yeah.
sometimes fucked up kids who just want to cause havoc because, you know, they're in a lot of pain or they're, you know, something else has happened. So there will be an out. And like we learned from, you know, the gospel, aka the wire, there's a lot more layers to this. And I wonder whether you've had experience, it does sound like you have, in universities and schools, where you do sort of take aside, you know, kids and say, look, you know, have you ever experienced bullying? Have you bullied yourself? Have you, do you do sort of awareness campaigns at that young age? Are you aware of the state, federal policies and initiatives which are focusing on that target audience to try and steer them away? Yeah.
Well, you know, that's one of the things we're seeing now. We're seeing, when I was involved in cybercrime, I had this misperception that the people who I was associated with were young.
Yeah.
You know, oh, they're young people. They're in their 20s at the latest. Well, it turns out, no, they're in their 40s, 50s, everything else at that point.
Brady. Really?
Okay. Yeah, there was, so my second in charge, Kim Taylor, he was 46 at that point. I was 35, he was 46. Mm. David Thomas was in his late 40s. Now, we had some young kids. Dmitry Golubov was 19. Mm. Jonathan James was a minor at that point. So we had young people too, but I was under the perception that everyone was young and I was the oldest person there. But what we're seeing now is we're seeing that entry into cybercrime much, much younger. It starts with bullying. It starts with being online with Fortnite or something like that, and you're complaining or you get pissed off. Someone kills you, you get pissed off. So what do I do? Well, let's get a tool and shut down Xbox Live. Let's try that. Let's try that. And that's where it starts. Or, you know, they're wanting the new game, so they start pirating it. So I'm pirating.
Really, you know, not too much has changed. I mean, DDoSing happened. Oh. That emerged in Counter-Strike when someone got, you know.
Exactly. I'll show you.
I guess when I talk to people about, you know, kind of the area that I sort of vacillate, I think the stoic mindset is best, you know. you realize that you're never going to totally win and you're never going to totally lose. And hey, you know, you do your best and I guess you try and live a happy life and then try and make the world a bit of a better place. And hey,
I'm going to tell you that right there, that philosophy is one thing that the bad guys forget and the good guys forget. You can only do so much. You know, don't let it ruin you. Don't let it consume you.
Yeah.
You know, you're not, for the good guys, you're not going to stop all crime. You're not going to stop all breaches. You can only do what you can do.
Yeah.
And I think that's important for us to remember that going forward.
Yeah, I think so. Otherwise, you just, you know, you drive yourself nuts.
You're right.
Mate, I have had an absolute blast. It's been
I have too. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no worries. And look, if anyone wants to find you, what's your website link? They can find you on LinkedIn or Twitter or.
Sure, I'm on LinkedIn under Gollum Fun, or you could just look for Brett Johnson's Cybercrime. That'll pop up.
Yep.
My website is anglerfish.com. That's anglerphish.com. I also have a podcast at onlinefraudcast.com.
Mm-hmm.
Going to be launching a couple other podcasts later this year. One is the Brett Johnson / Shadow Crew story, and there will be another one that looks at cybercrime as a whole. So I'll be bringing in people to interview and everything else. But I'm going to tell you, your podcast is outstanding.
Oh,
I love it, and I appreciate it. I'm honored to be on here. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Take care, mate. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.